my name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead. First point, we have power today, so that's a good sign, right? Yesterday it was dark for a few minutes, so this is good. Before I introduce Petter, I'd just like to point out I have evaluations around the fire ring, so if you could kindly fill one out, we so appreciate it. You can take it with you and put it in the evaluation envelope on the east side of the dining room. Hand it to me, or I have a education P.O. box in the post office, so we appreciate getting your feedback. So it's Friday already, can hardly believe it. So our last session, I know I don't mean to make people sad, but our last session with Petter Jothan, religion professor at St. Olaf, and he's going to kind of finish out the discussion, or not finish, continue the discussion of the political Bible. So just a reminder, if you're making comments, to use your outside playground voice, because sometimes it's a little bit difficult to hear people, but we want the comments. So thank you, Petter, for your time this week.
Thank you. I'm shocked there's so many people here today. It's beautiful out, it's Friday. Most of you would be out.
You promised to resolve everything.
Yeah, promise that. God did. Please pray with me. Spirit of the living God, thank you for this time together of renewal and rejoicing and questioning and challenge and conviction. Help us to carry this with us wherever we go as we make faith a verb. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thinking about what to do today, after a week of conversations, and you know, part of the way I approach teaching this class is that, or these sessions, is recognizing the fact that every day you're going to have different people. So I've tried to do it such that each session is sort of standalone. But one of the beauties of Holden is that there's lots of conversations going on, both in this session, but all the other sessions, at coffee break, and at lunch, and at dinner, and on lodge porches. And part of what I like to do, and for me a sort of fitting conclusion to the conversations that we've been having this week, whether you've been here since yesterday, or you've been here since last week, or even longer, is to sort of think about what does it mean to be human? In my session, part of what we talked about yesterday was the fact that certain kinds of nonviolent active resistance can be humanizing. But it begs the question, what does it mean to be human? Dan Spencer's sessions begs the question, okay, how do we really understand what it means to be human in light of the cosmos, and the biosphere, and the ecosystems? Claire's sessions about conversation and respect, based on some kind of understanding that we're all human together. And we've, in our sessions too, and we've talked about the covenant and baptism and the image of God. Those are kind of the ways we get around asking that question. What does it mean to be human? Especially for us as Christians, what does it mean to be human? Well, that's the question I want to sort of pursue today. And, to do it, I want to use the book of James. Anyone read James? Anyone? Were you supposed to read James? For those who weren't raised Lutheran, I suspect maybe James isn't a bad word. But Luther thought James should be thrown into the fire. He actually wrote this great line about throwing little Jimmy into the fire. He thought it was an epistle of straw. And part of my thinking about choosing as James is one of my sort of conversation partners as a professor is Soren Kierkegaard. And he wrote a book called For Self-Examination, where he focused on James. And why he did this is he felt that in his context, which was 19th century Denmark, what it meant to be a Christian was that you knew the creeds and then you had been confirmed. All you needed to know to be a Christian was to know the creeds and be confirmed. You gotta be baptized too. Obviously. That's what made you a Christian. His sort of authorship, which is varied and interesting and complex, pushed that question. Is that what it really means to be a Christian? And I think one of the themes that we've been pursuing this week that I see across all of the sessions is that being Christian is not about belief. It's about actions. It's about how you live in the world. It's about how you connect yourself and your gifts and your riches with those on the margins. Which begs the question, how can we find texts that provoke us to think about that better? And in particular, to do it better. And I think in the Lutheran tradition, to choose a text that's always sort of been on the margins and to reflect on it is a good place to start. But before we go to James, I'd like to have you think a little bit about the question I just asked. What does it mean to be human? So maybe turn to your neighbor. I might even use this thing called a board. let's think together about what it means to be human. So maybe 5 minutes of conversation around that question. You're talking. Okay. What are some thoughts? You had thoughts, you were talking. Yeah.
Now we thought of the words sympathy, empathy, and higher level of thinking.
Okay. So maybe broadly we could say, when I say self-awareness, higher level thinking, and love. And I'll say this. It's intentional love.
Yeah.
You can direct it. Not always. And I think part of the challenge is that there are loves inside of you that are shaped in ways that you can't be intentional as you want them to be. And they can be misintended. That's part of the challenge, I think, of being human. But these two are clear. Yeah.
Isn't part of our struggle is that we are animals.
Uh-huh.
And we have these, I think, some things in common with them, but we have some differences too, but sometimes we, I think, ignore that we have some of these basic needs within us that are identified with them, and this is part of the struggle.
Good, good. Yeah.
The more we die,
yeah.
Priorities, time and money.
Can we add that to self-awareness? That you can intend how you use time, gifts, let's say wealth.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
That work there?
Yep.
We can plan.
Maybe I'll add that to self-awareness. And I think another way to think about planning is we can envision a future. We're imaginative creatures, that because we have this faculty called the imagination, we can say, oh, this is what I'm gonna do at 10:10. Let me get another cup of coffee. Even though right now it's only 9:12.
Yeah, but animals can do a little bit of planning too. If you've ever had a pet who watches until you're gone before he jumps on the sofa.
Yeah, and maybe the distinction there is that our sense of the future is a lot broader.
Yes.
I mean, the fact that we know we're going to die, though for many of us that's way off. But yeah.
Are we narcissistic?
Ooh. Can I say more broadly, kind of generally, we're self-interested? Is that not what you're getting at, or?
It is.
Okay.
We couldn't decide whether to see that as selfish.
Okay. Well, I mean, being selfish, you can be healthily self-interested. I mean, arguably, you could say you're being self-interested by coming to this.
I think also think more negatively.
But clearly, it has negative connotations, too. You could be less self-interested by doing things that are more selfish. You know, I think that's, for instance, I know some of the stuff Dan Spencer's been doing. I think he's trying to appeal to your self-interest. That it's in our self-interest to change, because if we don't change, what's going to happen to us?
We're
going to
die.
Yes.
Sooner.
Yes.
So, I'm trying to think of something about language. I mean, animals communicate, but I don't know if it's written language or...
I don't know
what to say about language.
Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah, I'm trying to think how, I mean, part of what language is for us is forms of symbolic communication.
But we can write also, that's a biggie.
Yeah, but writing, what's a letter?
Symbol.
A letter is a symbol.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And different cultures have different symbols, and different symbols mean different things.
Good.
Like, wasn't our illustrious president in the Middle East, and he used his thumb? And then using your thumb is a, I think it's a sign of the phallus in most air countries. And he didn't know, he got off the plane, he was like.
Awareness of our place in the cosmos.
Okay.
Awareness of the cosmos.
I'll add that to self-awareness. It's like cosmic. Though, obviously, I think part of the challenge, too, for many of us is we don't see ourselves as cosmic. We see ourselves as this, just the self, I'm just me. Yeah?
Sinful.
Can we say imperfect, too, along with that, just to come up with some different ways to understand that? Broken? Yeah?
We're creative.
Oh, good.
And that can come out as playfulness, as humor. Or creating ideas, and we also have the capacity to destroy, and the choice.
That's good. Sigmund Freud has this great understanding of humans. He thinks we're both erotic creatures, that in our eroticism we create, and you want to create things in love, but we're all also creatures of death, thanatos. And we have these two opposing forces in us, in our subconscious that we're trying to make sense of. Yeah?
It strikes me that all those qualities are being human, not so much being Christian.
Exactly. That's the question
I'm asking. Bibles to all humanity.
Good. No, that's what I'm hoping for here. So, absolutely right. And it begs the question, what do we do with all these as Christians? Yes?
As humans, we are both vulnerable in the broadest sense and divine, whether we're Christian or not.
Say more about the divine part.
We are created in the image of God. And for me, the life that is in me is God.
So can we say we're both, by vulnerability, we're also talking about bodies?
Yes.
Because there's a lot we could go with vulnerability. Yeah.
Yes.
We're divine, there's something in us, that a spark of something or a reflection of something that is beyond just our bodies. That's good. Yeah.
This might go with being animals, but we're born with five senses, and so we're taking in the universe whether we want to or not.
That's great. Can I say we're sensual creatures? But, you know, in some ways, well, I'm going to do it this way. We're also intellectual creatures. We can think, that's part of our self-awareness. Yeah.
We wrote love and then you put intentional, I think.
Yeah.
The other reality, being human, is you're limited and your vision starts to fade. So I think that says intentional. But there's also a sense in which love, part of being human is that there is love that you don't intend. It is just the capacity to have love drawn from you. That's partly sensual, it's partly erotic, but it is also parental, it's friendship. There is the capacity to love, or the need, the reality, the tendency to love other persons is somehow intrinsic to being human. And it of course can be directed, but it, people love whom they love.
Sure.
And,
maybe one way to get at that is that I think we're both individuals, but need a bigger word, that's a good thing. We're an individual, but we're also social. So our love, then, is dependent on how we maneuver between these two
relational
kinds of relational structures. Yeah?
I've always wondered about this image of God. We assume that this is a physical image that God made us. We are spiritual, and maybe our image has nothing to do with our body at all, but our image has been created within the image of God, our spirit.
Or another way, and I think Jürgen Moltmann, the great German theologian, does this. He, in some ways, thinks the image of God is this. We're bodies that have breath in us. And if you read the creation myth, it's these images of God breathing into creation. And all life shares in this breath. Plants breathe. Animals breathe. That's a beautiful image, I think, to really get at that kind of, that all things have this image of God in them, not just humans. We have self-awareness of it in a unique way. Yeah?
We have free will, but good. It's limited by chemistry, physics, and biology.
Yeah. Or I want to say that we're both creatures that have some form of freedom. Freely, you can get up and leave.
Some people.
Some.
You know, I mean, we all have limitations.
Yeah, sure. Well, what I'm going to say, I think the creature is also a fate or destiny. And I think this, when you start to think about human, it also opens up the door to the fact that in order to answer the question of what it means to be human, you can't just go to a sacred text. Because part of fate has to do with, you know, where do I get my blue eyes? Where do I get my five fingers, five hands? Genetics. I come from a long line of Scandinavians who have dark nights of the soul. You know, it's in me. It's in my coding. And that's fated. And I'm not going to be a 6'8" basketball player. And fate, too, not just from sort of an evolutionary perspective, fate from where you were raised and how you were raised. And my parents were church musicians, so whether I liked it or not, I know how to sing. I didn't like it when I was a kid, but I was fated in some ways to go in that direction. So, but we also have degrees of freedom. We can reject things, we can accept things, we can go in different directions, but not utter freedom.
So even though you practiced a lot, you wouldn't be a good basketball player?
It's a Velcro on his shoes.
Yeah, one of those spring things. But no. Other thoughts? Any other thoughts? I have a couple. And part of what I'm going to do, too, here is try and connect the dots a little bit. We're mortal, but I think most of us as Christians believe that we have some eternal dimension. Might be a mystery, we might be confused about it, but most of us believe that there's something beyond this life. And that in some ways we live that idea of resurrection, because a powerful symbol in our language of faith. I think we're also creatures in time, and because we're creatures in time, we all have histories. And when you start to talk about time, you start to talk about the fact that all of us have a past, and that past impacts our present. And because it impacts our present, it impacts our future. Going back to some of these issues with fate and faith. Stop there. And I want to go back to your question. So what does all this stuff mean as Christians?
Well, I sort of went there on the first question, and I mean, as human, but what are we called to be as Christians? We are created in the image of God, and so is everybody else, and we're called to treat everybody with love and respect.
Okay. So it goes back to those stories that we tell, that our sacred text tells us about who we are. Other thoughts about what do we do with these kind of understandings, what it means to be a human generally? Well, what I think, whether you want to hear it or not, what we do as Christians is we put these together, we integrate these, we intertwine them, we relate to them through our sacred text, through our sacred stories, through our example of what it means to be human, which is Christ. And by doing that, we're never either or. We're always amidst these intentional, unintentional loves. Sin and salvation. Being mortal and being eternal. Being an animal, yet being some sort of higher aware animal. Between being creative and destructive. But it's faith that calls us to hold those together in tension, in relationships, in a way that we call Christian. So our job as Christians, then, is to
envelop ourselves in the story that we call the Bible, God's story, that calls us to relate these lovely, complex, challenging, frustrating ways of being human in particular ways. So our job then, in our sort of responsibility then from the Bible, is to make sense of how do we do this? How do we recognize both being sinful, yet being creative, being destructive, yet being hopeful, being vulnerable, yet being divine, being bodily, yet being spiritual? How do we do all those things? But I think that's what we're called to do, which gets us to James. So can you turn to James? And if you haven't read James, you know, I'm not super surprised in a Lutheran context that you wouldn't have. I think I only read it this spring. Or this January. I had to teach it in a great books class. But as my wife would tell you, it's not surprising that I hadn't read it. When I first met her, I thought Ruth was an apocryphal book. I'll claim that. So I want to start with 122 through 124, because I think it is a terrific way to imagine what the Bible is broadly in this kind of sense of what it means to be human. And I think by doing this, then we're giving greater depth to the reality that we need to have. We need to have conversations with people who are different. We need to have conversations with those who convict us. We need to have moments of contemplation to understand how to put these tensions in us together and hold them in tension without either saying we're saved or we're sinner, but we're both, to use sort of the Lutheran rhetoric that I think is so embedded in who we are as Lutherans. So I'm going to read 122 to 124.
But be doers of the word, and not merely hearers who deceive themselves. For if any are hearers of the word and not doers, they are like those who look at themselves in a mirror. For they look at themselves, and on going away immediately forget what they were like. But those who look into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and persevere, being not hearers who forget, but doers who act, they will be blessed in their doing.
What does this text tell us about the Bible, God's word? What does it tell us about it?
It's an instruction manual.
It tells us how to act in the world, doesn't it? And if you think about what we've been talking about this week, as well as a lot of the other sessions, what does that action look like? What kind of does that life look like? What does that existence look like?
It's challenging.
It's challenging. Why?
Because we are of this world, and yet we are of God as well.
Okay. We're both?
I'm only human.
You're only human? Okay. Yeah.
I guess one of the problems coming to Holden is you get so much in your head that's all good stuff. And how much do you ultimately retain? And this is the thing, is we're in the patterns that we have to change. And change is hard.
That elephant, if you were here, we talked it one day about how much of what we do is determined not by our mind, our higher self-awareness, but the loves that we have. One thinker calls an elephant, and the elephant is a lot, it's very difficult to move that elephant.
Also earlier in the week we talked about false prophets, and that's a challenge of discernment, because there are a lot of voices to instruct us how to live, and the difference being which prophets show us a way of creating and life, and which bring death and destruction.
Good.
But we think you're good.
No, I'm not.
I think it just says, don't be a couch potato.
Say more.
I'm not just supposed to sit. This is just an action. Get to work. Do something. Don't just listen and say, oh, that's dandy. Get out there and do something. Make a phone call. Write a letter.
Right. Good. Write a letter. So what are you supposed to do?
Liberate ourselves.
Liberate ourselves. So part of it is about us, that notion of conviction, that notion that we often, frequently, myself included, think we're better than we are, that we are living the life that God intends for us. And that worldly success is a sign of living the life that God intended for us. Popularity, power, social standing. So it's conviction here. What else are we supposed to do?
Love one another.
Love one another. That's easy, right? I want to skip to James 2:14. Because here's another moment. James is actually very ethical. He's much more ethical than he is theological. In fact, Christ is only mentioned twice. I think a number of early church writers were wondering whether this was more of a Jewish text than a Christian text. So I think part of the debates around the text were whether this belonged in the Bible. Luther's big problem with it was that it was he thought it was all about works and not about faith. And I think the challenge for us, I think our tendency, at least my tendency, maybe I'll speak from my own experience, is to focus on grace, not the conviction, not the law, not the lack, not the frustration with what I'm not doing and should be doing. Now, for me, I justify it. Well, I got kids. I can't go to that protest. They need to be in bed. It's convicting. It's convicting. So I want to read 2:14 to 2:17.
What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith but do not have works? Can faith save you? If a brother or a sister is naked and lacks daily food, and if one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm, and eat your fill, and do not supply their bodily needs, what is the good of that? So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead.
What does that tell us about what it means to be human?
How many times have we said, I'll pray for you, if you need more?
What is life if you're not moving?
Say more.
What
is life if you're not moving?
Yeah, what is life? I mean, if you're not creating and doing something, what are you doing?
Couch potato eating.
Yeah.
But what about the person who is severely injured or elderly, and can't do? I remember reading a story once. And in it, a nun who had been active all of her life was now bedridden. Mm-hmm. And she said, my job is to pray. Mm-hmm. And so praying does have a place for us.
I think prayer can be active.
Yeah.
But that's a good question. I mean, part of it, I don't think we as Christians expect everyone to do the same kinds of actions.
No.
I think that reduces the fact that all of us, at the same time, you know, we could debate this, but these are sort of universal characteristics of what it means to be human. At the same time, they're universal. All of us, through our own faith life, are relating these differently. So there's particularity there. There's difference there. And I think we need to sort of figure out ways to honor that. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Good point. Yeah?
I think it calls us to live our faith, which we talked about quite a bit. I mean, not only in our daily lives, but in our social circles, in our work, in our nation, in our world, to actually live our life of faith instead of just to have it in our hearts. I think we have to live it. And once you live it, you can then share it with stories that you know, I think about my grandchildren and the life I've lived. If you live a life of faith, it takes you to wonderful places and you have amazing experiences, both good and bad, but you get through it. And those are then stories that you can share and pass on that I think build faith in others.
But not only that, one of the things we've talked about throughout this week, a number of the different sessions, is how important stories are. I think, in fact, the best way to understand how you integrate these is through stories.
which is, to me, part of the power of the Bible. You know, if it's just a book of faith, or if it's just a book of instructions, it's just a bunch of aphorisms, I don't think it has the same power. But I think the Bible is this living word, it's this living story, which God asks us to live in and through and by. And the complexity of the text itself is such that you can't just pick and choose. You can't just decide what you think it is. Because when you do that, there's other texts that say, no, no. That tension between sort of conviction and confession, between conversation in the text, between active understanding and sort of being passively listening to what the text has to say as you read it. Yeah?
In terms of the story, what's the narrative I tell myself? In that first text, I was curious, be doers of the word. So what's the word? And look backwards, and it shows up twice in the two preceding paragraphs. In fulfillment of God's own purpose, God gave us birth by the word of truth. And then verse 11, with the implanted word that has the power to save us all. So there's that infusion of grace that is part of the narrative before we ever get to these, here's what you need to do. That we don't get lost in that part to tell the whole story. Part of what it means to be a person is to have that word, to be a product of the word, if you will, and to have it in us.
The word with a capital W.
They don't capitalize the capital W.
The word made flesh in Christ and in Christ.
Good.
Also, I think there's a promise here that you don't just have to grit your teeth and say, okay, I've got to do this stuff because that's what I have to do. But the promise toward the end of verse 25, chapter 1:25, but doers who act, they will be blessed in their doing. And I think a lot of us have had the experience of stretching ourselves a bit and taking action in one way or another, in helping and loving, where we feel we're the ones that are blessed. Mm-hmm. That blessing comes to us.
Well, I think the text too, going back to what with the 2:14, I mean, part of the text says how dependent we are on each other. What's our responsibility as humans? What does the word call us to do? It calls to make sure that we're all fed and clothed.
As people of faith, I think we're God's hands and feet on this earth to do this work.
I think he's describing the effect of being filled with the word rather than prescribing that we are to do things in order to be filled.
This goes back to his point in some ways, that we have that in us, we have that potential, we have that capacity. It's given to us by God.
It's inevitable.
If we don't let our intentions and our self-awareness and our sin sort of turn away from it. Just obviously a challenge.
I can see a possibility of Luther not liking this 25 that you were talking about, though, because it almost talks like if you do this, you're going to get a reward. And how many of us have done some good things and nothing is noted of it, but you still did it? There isn't necessarily a reward in that respect, maybe from God, but not from on earth here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Luther's big issue, well, first off, I think the challenge for us as Lutherans, you identified that, is Luther's always in conversation with a tradition that is emphasizing the power of penitent works. That they downgrade sort of God's grace as a result. And I think if you read Luther correctly, and I think this is a really hard challenge, I think, for Lutherans to explain. And a quick story is a good friend of mine I went to grad school with. He's African American, he was raised Baptist. Every time he would talk to me, he'd ask me how I was doing, and I would always be like, oh, you know, I'm okay. And he'd pull out his Bible verses, and, well, Paul says that fruits of great love. And he could never understand why I was always so, like, balanced or wishy-washy about how I was doing. And then he went to work for the ELCA. The main office in Hagerstown. And the next time I saw him, he's like, now I get you, Petter. You know, not too happy, not too sad. Yeah.
Lutheran pastors never agreed with Martin Luther about James.
Oh, good.
Because I think it's a brilliant book. Seems to me Luther was asking different questions of the book.
Yeah.
Why he couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
And it, you know, when you read James, the issue of faith, you know, it seems to me Luther's asking the question, and Lutherans generally ask the question, do my works or my faith save me? And it seems to me what James is saying is, your faith lived out in works save your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Or bring life to your
neighbor.
That's a very different question.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we have to be coming at it from the right angle to understand how James is so valuable.
That's beautiful, yeah. James is, for Luther, James, it's a polemical read of James. Yeah.
And those good works for our neighbor make us more human. Mm-hmm. So we're human among humans, and we become more.
Other thoughts? I want to go back to
where we started with 122. Can someone read 123 again and 24?
This is a metaphor I want to stick with.
For if any are hearers of the word and not doers, they are like those who look at themselves in a mirror.
Read the next verse. Amy.
For they look at themselves and on going away, immediately forget what they were like.
What's a mirror? What's a mirror? Reflects yourself. Doesn't a mirror allow you to see what you look like? See what you're doing? See how you're making sense of your things? My daughter right now is really liking mirrors.
Lately, when I look in the mirror, I see my mother.
How do I follow that? Okay, we're done for today.
Is that good or bad? Unfortunately, it's good. It's a story that fits the Christian story, so I was fortunate.
Why do you think James is using this image of a mirror? What's he telling us? What does he want us to imagine?
He wants to get away from the deception, because he said the mirror tells the truth. I mean, mirror kind of tells the truth, you know, if you,
I think he's telling us to live the word.
Mm-hmm.
And not just look at this, not just look at this, read it, put it down and go away. But to take it with us. Is that reflection?
Well, also, what do you think the mirror is reflecting, really?
Where you really are. Yeah, I agree. But at the end of verse 24 is interesting. Immediately forget what they were like. What is it that they're forgetting? We're forgetting. Then. Are we forgetting that we're sinners and not doing what we're supposed to be, maybe? Or are we forgetting that we are created in the image of God and forgetting what we should be doing?
You know, when Paul uses the image of the mirror, it's a dim reflection. It's a mirrors will not shiny perfect reflector effect. They reflect it back, distorted or dim view of yourself.
That's right.
So I think he's looking at a mirror is not a good thing. The whole point is don't bother to look at the mirror. Right? That's what he's saying. Instead of looking in the mirror, look outside. Look into the perfect law instead of the mirror.
Well, what's the better question? What's the true mirror where you're supposed to see yourself?
I think you're supposed to see what you're really like.
What's a true mirror? What's an accurate reflection of who you are?
The word of truth.
Loved? Graced? Sinner, convicted, neighbor, friend, Samaritan, rabbi, Levite, disciple, Judas. This is our mirror. This is the mirror that we can look at every day and get a reflection of who we are. And I think it's a really powerful image that James gives us.
Can't other people be used as mirrors? I mean, they'll tell you what they see in you if you listen.
And yet sometimes we're not, the mirror isn't everything, because we see what we choose to see or what we're disposed to see. Mm-hmm. Even if you're looking at a mirror sometimes, mm-hmm. you can fool yourself to some degree.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I think we're people of tunnel vision.
Say that one more time.
Tunnel vision. I was 33 years at a voluntary EMP, and I would go to an accident scene, and we'd have For 33 years, I was an EMT, a volunteer EMT, and you go to an accident scene, and you concentrate on so much of one thing that when you talk to the others, you find out all else is going on. And I think that we can do that with ourselves too. We'll focus so much on one that we totally miss what else is there. Mm-hmm. Tunnel vision is very prevalent in the human being.
Yeah.
And
also thinking of cars, like car mirrors too, and thinking about blind spots, and thinking of us as social beings, is that we have this mirror, but we also come together in community so people can point out our blind spots. And so that's maybe where people can be an extension of mirrors. Like how many times have we been driving in a car and changing lanes, and the person with us says like, whoa, yeah. Like there's a car, and
never,
we almost
never
miss
me.
It.
My mirror.
When I look in a mirror, I smile, and so I look better. And when I see a photograph, of course, I also smile for a photograph if I know it's being taken, but sometimes when I see photographs where I didn't know it was being taken, I see another picture that I don't like. Tear that one.
I want to read one other section now. Can someone read 3:13? To 3:18, please.
Who is wise and understanding among you? Show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness, born of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not be evil and false to the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, devilish. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there will also be disorder and wickedness of every kind. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace for those who make peace.
So we have a number of passages, and I encourage you to read James as a whole. But we read 2:14 and talked about the need, how dependent we are on each other for those basic needs, hunger, clothes. Here we're talking about wisdom. In some ways, we're talking about the wisdom is, how do you act? How do you do these faith works? How is faith itself not just a belief, but a way of being in the world? In fact, I think faith, a better way to think about faith is a verb, not a noun. Faithing. It's a doing, not just a believing. Not just a thing. Existence. So what does this tell us about what it means to be, as a person of faith, uniting these disparate dimensions to our person? What's it telling us? What's it calling us to be? What kind of mirror is it?
Well, we tend to think, well, we're not really so bad, but certainly all of us would, I think, have to admit we're selfish and envious, and this sort of shows us what that leads to, and to be what we're called to be, gentle, peaceable, full of mercy and good. So I don't think we can be that without opening ourselves up to God and to change.
Yeah. When I read the scriptures like this, wisdom from above, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without trace of partiality. And I picture myself at a protest. there seems to be a conflict there. Hmm.
There's a I think she's pointed out there's a conflict between this sort of peaceable, selfless, gentle,
full of mercy,
and protesting, active protesting.
And yet, there must be ways in which that spirit of mercy is what moves us to protest against the unmerciful. But it does not appear to be peaceable when we are in the midst of it. Too often protests become almost violent or strident in its effect.
But what about when Christ tipped over the table of the money changers? That was not a passive event.
Peace is not passive.
I just speak for the women's march that I was in on Whidbey Island, and I think it was pretty much the same in all the women's marches, that there was no violence. There was a lot of humor, and there were some words that were perhaps questionable, I don't know, but there was a lot of humor, there was a lot of uplifting of the spirit in that, and I think it was a peaceful march.
That's right. I participated in it.
But I think that it is a terrific point that I think the how you do something, how you protest matters. And to be careful about how you protest. It's important to protest. It's important to be prophetic. And I think at times you do have to be angry. You do have to be strident. But keep your ego in check. Keep your ambition in check. Keep your self-interest in check. Ma'am, I know you had a...
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, going back to just looking at the mirror and focusing on a smile, but to look at the book and focus on being a child of God and taking it from there, and that, because this was before the idea of a protest, but in peace, you know, to stand for something meaningful, and I don't know how you can be meaningful to others who don't think like you without being objectionable.
Say that one more time. I'm not sure.
Louder, please.
Okay. The people read into things possibly about their objection to what you're doing, although it's peaceful.
Okay. So there's risk.
Yes.
Maybe there's a risk doing these kinds of actions because people are going to misinterpret, misunderstand it. Mm-hmm. Be confused about why you're doing it. That
yeah, and I don't know. Maybe some of us have been raised not to protest. Not, you know, that's a real uncomfortable kind of thing. And it's hard, you know, to have someone more brave, maybe, as an example.
Like Jesus.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think it also. I mean, when protests cause discomfort for other people. I mean, I'm thinking of the Black Lives Matter protests in the Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. It's one thing if you're walking along the street and you're, you know, you have signs and you're chanting and singing, but then you go onto the highway.
Yeah.
Or then you block the end. I mean, this is where people got
Flounder Castillo,
really upset.
2 weeks ago.
You know, you have a flight at the airport and
and then Minnesota was going to criminalize those.
Yeah,
right.
I mean,
fine.
Yeah,
and I think it was a felony, possibly. It didn't pass.
Yeah. They were going to criminalize what?
Protesting that would shut down or block any type of public transportation facility, like a highway or the light rail. You don't want to prevent people from going to work.
How else are they going to listen?
I think it's a brilliant act of protest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's something about protesting. I don't know how I haven't processed it completely, but I know the one that I was at, we were, you couldn't get anywhere close to the detention center at Dilley, in a little town way out in the boondocks in Texas, and where women and children were being, immigrant women and children were being held. And they wouldn't let us get anywhere close to the grounds, so literally with the bishop, you know, this group of about 50 or 60 people held a kind of a little service in the ditch beside the road. We didn't close the road. Well, it's hard to say. What good does that do, you know, because here we were, you know, walked out in the sun to a mile to do that, and who saw it? Mm-hmm. And but you still, I don't know, it was still an experience for me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it takes a long process.
I may have the story wrong, but Dr. Spock saw...
Louder?
What's that?
Louder.
Dr. Spock saw in front of the White House a couple of women in like miserable weather protesting nuclear arms. And he just got curious. And he went and commissioned and asked them, what are you doing? And because of that, he got deeply involved. It was so powerful to see just two people out there. And I hope I have the story right, but I'm pretty sure that's how it goes. And it was very, very empowering, and it didn't take a lot of people. The other piece, just following up on what you said, you know, faith and works, and it's in the community that you see the action. In teaching, I've done, I thought that I had a great lesson. Going somewhere, and then I had, for lack of a better term, come back and bite me in the ass, and I'm like, oh my God, he's not feeding me. Or I've offended somebody, and I messed up. And then there are other times where I didn't anticipate it would work well, or it worked so well, I can just walk out of the room, and there's where the mirror comes in. Then you know. And you know when you've offended and you've been messed up, because you see it right in front of you. There, I did my works, and then oops, somehow I messed up. The other end is, I can walk down the hall and take a coffee break, and they're still at it. They're still doing everything because they're so involved. And it has its implications with everything we do, and our works.
Great.
I think, and I think James might go along this line, that we're in the mode of protest or seeking change can easily spill over into self-righteousness and a lack of self-critical awareness. And I think we're at a moment in the life of protest in our culture that there needs to be some new creativity in thinking about how to do that to be more effective, one. And I think the willingness to ask, if we are going to physically restrict other people's movement, is that still nonviolent? When you are stopping other bodies from going where they need to go, can you call that nonviolent protest? And I think we need to really ask whether the protest itself creates the violent response in some situations. I'm not saying at all. And just be willing to ask those hard questions about the assumed patterns of what protest is, or what nonviolent protest is.
Yeah, it's a tough conversation, and I think it's hard for us. I mean, maybe we're allies, but we're not directly impacted by those communities. Or, how do we have conversations where we support the?
I'm just going to ask you room to explore those questions. I don't have the answers, but often you're not even allowed to ask those questions because of the self-righteousness of the protest.
There is just anger.
So. I'm not saying that's, certainly.
I think this passage and what it demands is kind of impossible. And maybe that's the point. I think any time you step out in a protest, maybe you're called to do it, but you're also going to be a hypocrite. And I think also when you see other people protesting and you think, oh, gosh, that looks violent, that looks bad, that can be hypocrisy too. I mean, mm-hmm. no matter what, we're always complicit, we're always going to be messing up, mm-hmm. and the point is to just notice it. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of things in the Bible are just, you just have to recognize that they're impossible, and I think that's where grace comes in, mm-hmm. and faith, but just knowing that you have, once you get out there, that's it, you know. I'm sure Dorothy Day struggled with that. I'm sure Jesus struggled with that. It's just what comes with acting.
I do think it's the part of the beauty and brilliance of the Lutheran tradition is it shouldn't leave you into that road of passivity saying, I can't do it anyway. I just live by grace. Mm-hmm. I mean, that moment of conviction that
One of the playwrights wrote, to do the wrong, to do the right thing for the wrong reason is treason. And when you get into this, you know, trying to figure out the motivation of things, it's very tricky.
I'll just also, I know we're over time. Oh, maybe, I don't know how many people you had your hand up.
Well, I think, you know, as we're talking about protesting and challenging the systems that are bigger than ourselves, I think we also have to acknowledge that we're being admonished to be peaceable and open to reason in our own spheres of influence where we are the system. We have a sphere of influence in our own communities and in our own micro-communities where we can demonstrate that openness. You know, oftentimes in positions of leadership to change the rigidity that's within our own small communities, whether that's in education or in civics or in anything else where access and privilege are denied to people who don't look like us. And it doesn't take a protest to do that, but I think that's part of this text as well, that we model that and we insist on that in our own micro level, our sphere of influence.
And I'll say this, and maybe we'll end here because I know we're over time. Looks like they're taking a big group photo over there. But part to your point about, does it matter? Well, I think that's the wrong question. I think the right question is to say, this is what you're called to do as a Christian. And the consequences aren't up to us. The consequences, like solving the world's problems, aren't up to us. But we as Christians are called to be with the hungry, to be with the refugee, to be with the marginalized. Not because we're going to fix things, but because that's what it means. That's the character. That's the way we integrate these things. That's what it means to be human from a Christian sense. What it means to make faith a verb. Thank you. I appreciate this week. I've had a good week.